Welcome to Doing Sustainability, a podcast that features practical and actionable approaches to sustainability, brought to you by Baker. In every episode, we have enlightened conversations with corporate and business leaders on the vision, motivation, actions, and impacts of sustainability.
We discuss best practices, fresh perspectives, tips, and solutions to help a company demonstrate its ESG commitment and position themselves for long-term success. Hi, I'm your host, Rocket.
And I'm your host, Gary. Let's start the show.
Today, we're speaking with Randy Burns. Welcome, Randy, to Doing Sustainability.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Randy has spent his career using the power of ideas and creativity to communicate, negotiate, write, persuade, and influence, and yes, even litigate, a path through the constraints of today to unlock what needs for tomorrow. That's a mouthful, but I love all that and can really dig into that. He likes to work on the frontiers of where challenge is occurring, behaviors, rules, and inspirations are colliding, and a paradigm is probably shifting, where business, law, and policy, or an organization, its rules, behaviors, and strategy are misaligned for progress, where what we need and want tomorrow is cattywampus with what we have today. That's almost always a place of some powerful or outdated status quo, laws, policies, rules, behaviors, norms, habits, or mindsets holds back an idea, team, or an organization from achieving a breakthrough change or innovation solution. There's also where human decision to make change is necessary and sufficient for success. It's a place where inspiration to act results from human connections that involve ideas plus creativity plus learning plus critical thinking plus strategy plus trust building communications. Those elements are the foundation of his leadership philosophy. Randy is the Chief Sustainability Officer and Corporate Affairs Officer at OI Glass. And he's been there since 2017, formerly the VIP Global Government Affairs and Legal Legacy Strategy. And before that, a VP of Asbestos Litigation. Prior, he was a shareholder, partner, and associate with several law firms. He got his law degree from the University of Virginia Law School and also attended Stanford and the Executive Education Program. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Glad to have a conversation.
So I want to jump back into some of your interests here. Your interests include behavioral psychology, economics, business strategy, negotiation theory, law and philosophy, and communications. So what aspect of behavioral psychology interests you and why?
Decision-making, how we make decisions. So the interests that you listed there that I have all relate to each other if you see the common thread, which is people are necessary to make change. The decisions people make are necessary to make change. And as a result, as a leader who wants to make change happen, you have to understand how people make decisions and the things that you need to do to positively influence that type of decision making. And so there are pieces of that that exist in behavioral economics, behavioral psychology, and communication in law, right? I mean, at some level, what lawyers do, at least litigation lawyers, is influence people. Try to convince 12 people who don't care about you or your problems to say yes when you ask them, or no, as the case may be. So there's a thread for all of those things, and I think they change makers that I meet are very good at understanding how people make decisions and what they need to do to close distances between each other. And when they do that well, change happens.
Tell us how you see the relevance of sustainability. And there's a lot, because it's all about decisions, about sustainability and behavioral psychology.
Well, sustainability doesn't happen without collaboration. You can't mandate sustainability. You can't edict sustainability. You have to nurture sustainability. And when you think about the broad concept of sustainability as one in which you are taking an organization or collection of things and trying to make them as close to a perpetual motion machine as possible, using the least amount of inputs, creating the least amount of outputs, that's something that works very well with its surroundings and probably something we want more of over time. There are a number of arms and legs to those problems, all of which require people to make decisions going in the same direction and positioning what you want them to do, why you want them to do it, and how you suggest they do it, and the outcome that those series of decisions provide is what sustainability leaders do. So if you want somebody to be concerned about climate change, you better understand how people make decisions, and you better understand how to position the narrative with the audience that you want to influence in a way that they will take the actions that you suggest are necessary, right? And I would just contrast that with an approach that basically uses a narrative that appeals to a base or a sold group of people already. So the people I need to convince in my business to make sustainable decisions and change their behaviors are not the ones that already believe in sustainability, okay? And they're probably not the ones that are never going to believe in sustainability. If those people exist in the world, I don't believe they do. But really, it's the people that are unsure about things involving that. I need to know, and any sustainability leader needs to know the audience, know what motivates them, what they want to hear, and position things in a way that influences their decision-making in a positive way. So there's nothing about being a sustainability leader that doesn't draw on every single one of those things every day. So that's why I think about them all the time and why this area interests me.
So your company is kind of a sustainability natural. It's inherent in your product. And this may be an easy question for you, may not be easy for others, but let's talk about business strategy and sustainability strategy merging.
Well, that's a great topic because it's one of my favorites. It's one of my favorites because let's just think about this for a second. So I believe glass is the most sustainable packaging material that you could pick because it solves for every sustainability issue that packaging needs to solve for, except for two. And it's only temporary, by the way. Weight and energy intensiveness. Not that the other substrates don't have energy intensiveness issues either. Let's just say those are really the only criticisms about glass, right? Infinitely recyclable, doesn't lose quality or material when you recycle it. It's inert, doesn't have food contact problems, et cetera. But that product in and of itself may be sustainable for those reasons. But like anything else, if you don't make it sustainably, you're not a sustainable organization. So in that regard, if you want to make something sustainably, or if you want your organization to seek the balance that sustainability represents, which is balancing the needs and interests of your organization with the competing needs of the other organizations or stakeholders, which include the planet, so people, planet, prosperity, okay, that's the balance that sustainability represents. If you want your organization to move closer to that balance and away from, let's just call it less of an equilibrium, your business strategy has to solve for sustainable outcomes in addition to the economic outcomes for which most businesses are programmed to solve. Okay, so shareholder primacy drives most business-making decisions in the United States and elsewhere. And the key is to figure out how to make a business's strategy also solve for sustainability outcomes in a way that's consistent with largely the programming the organizations have, right? So business leaders just in and of themselves probably won't just solve for sustainability outcomes if it has a huge P&L impact that isn't positive, that increases the business's cost, for example, that lowers the margin or does something because it's seen as greener or more beneficial or whatever. There has to be a way to do it in which the cost can be rationally internalized, if you think about it from economic externality point of view, or that the value chain can absorb the additional cost to change how things are done. That's the collaboration piece that's necessary. So to me, the holy grail of a sustainability leader's job is figuring out how to create governance processes in an organization that simultaneously solve for the economic outcomes and the sustainability outcomes. So people can see a chief sustainability officer's role in many ways. I see it as one where I'm trying to influence and change behaviors in such a way that the decision-making points in my organization seek the equilibrium and balance that sustainability represents, be organic. So I should be able to work myself out of a job in theory, over time, if I'm successful. But my job right now is to create an organization that solves for those outcomes organically as the governance and processes that base to do that.
Well, you're lucky. You're working with human beings, so I think you have job security.
That's an interesting way to think about that, Gary. I never really, the sustainability theme that's in there is pretty sustainable when there's an infinite amount of change to make with human beings.
I'm reading a book and we're having a guest come back, and she wrote a book called Higher Ground, How Business Can Do the Right Thing in a Turbulent World. And humans are fallible creatures. And, you know, we may do something really great for 10 days, but oops, there's that one day that, you know, things aren't so great. Another thing, I know you're going to love this topic because I love to talk about it. Again, you are a little unique in that you have this great sustainable product that you are dealing with, but some companies think about sustainability as a risk. So there's this whole notion about doing it to manage risk versus value creation. And then I think a little bit of what you were talking about is getting the mindset over in the value creation category, aligning business strategy and sustainable strategy and creating value in various aspects of your business.
That's the other side of the coin of what I was talking about. You summarized that and teed up that topic as well as you could. Because in my worldview, you mitigate the business risks associated associated with things like climate change, waste, water usage, biodiversity, or whatever is in your business, because you have a sustainability strategy that is causing your organization to seek the balance that sustainability represents. It automatically mitigates those risks. And the disconnect that often occurs is sustainability as a risk mitigator is seen as a cost, not as a value creator. It's actually the exact opposite if you view sustainability as a balance-seeking exercise in which you are solving for those outcomes in a way that distributes value and internalizes costs in a meaningful way and provides positive externalities or benefits to the community they don't have to pay for. And that happens whenever you create a process that uses less raw materials, that is less dependent on certain energy sources, that preserves biodiversity, or whatever the sustainability question is that we're talking about, uses less water. So that's the way I position it when I talk about it inside the business. I say, what's your climate change strategy? I say, well, it's the other side of my sustainability strategy. My sustainability strategy works. My company will automatically de-risk our climate change problems. And I'd rather position it as a way to build value and create something than the opposite view, which is the risk manager position, you know, with which I have many years of experience.
So another aspect of I want to talk about behavioral psychology, I've had clients that somehow they get focused on the shiny object and they think the shiny object is going to be their salvation for their problem. It's going to be the solution for their problem, if we can grab that. And I know that you have dealt with this shiny object syndrome as well.
So there's two dimensions to this. Maybe they're the same dimensions that you would think about when you think about this, but maybe they're not. So everything that I like about behavior psychology is it creates self-awareness that we are risk-averse, status quo-seeking couch potatoes at base. That's what we're wired to do. And so when you interpret how people behave in certain situations or how they should behave or respond in certain situations, usually that's the point that you want to look at. So there's a part of us that if we're not self-aware, that that's what we want to do. We end up being very unsatisfied or frustrated with where we happen to be in life because we think we need something else, call it a shiny object, or we need a state of being, or we need something to occur in the future in order to make what we're doing or we have today seem like it is positive, good, maybe even great. And when you look at how communications exist in the marketplace about sustainability, it's a good example of how this plays out. Lots of people are interested in announcing the new shiny object as a way to, and they want you to think that that's a proxy for something that is sustainability in and of itself. Like, you know, we're going to have a big R&D announcement and you should think of us as more sustainable than somebody else. And if you're not making those announcements, you might consider yourself, oh, if that just happened, I would be working at a company that was that sustainable. When in reality, if you just stop and you're in the moment for a minute, if you're present, and you stop and experience what's going on in your organization, then you might realize that the things that the organization is doing are fantastic. They're making progress and the journey that they're on, the equilibrium that's being achieved and sought is far greater than whatever shiny object announcement could be made in the press, right? And I would just put OI into that category. We have been innovating and leading, and we are have a strategy that we're executing on deliberately. And it's very easy when somebody makes some announcement in our industry that they're going to trial something or whatever to create some sort of self-confidence crisis about the strategy and what we're doing. But I think it's the time, and I urge people to channel their Californian, if they're not in touch with it yet, to be present and appreciate and to really feel and experience today so that you can also experience the gratitude and the satisfaction of what you've helped create and what's taking place right before our very eyes.
A lot of what you're talking about to me that speaks to me is, you know, your job of sustainability is really never done. And so, you know, it's constantly moving. So sometimes the shiny object, thinking of it as a solution, really becomes that it's a one and done. It's not a one and done. And even when you're, you know, progressively keeping things aligned, which is really the best you can do, you never know what's going to really happen with climate change. So you're always still going to be evolving and rising to the occasion. And that's why I think that it's so interesting how it not only sparks innovation, but it also encourages that collaboration with competitors, which I think that that's really different than the way that business was run 20 years ago.
One of my hopes is that collectively, as you know, business organizations have lots of influence in sustainability. So do our communities, by the way. Like how we live matters just as much. The light that I wish would turn on more quickly, it will eventually, is that the balance that we want to obtain only occurs all of the things achieve the same, you know, are seeking the same level of balance and get there together. Because if you don't do that, something is my favorite Texan word, cattywampus. It's just out of whack. And so when you have a situation in which there's pressure to do sustainability or there's opportunism commercially or economically to use sustainability, it naturally is pulling on the balance in a way that is unhelpful sometimes. What you're describing to me is the recognition that the value chain in a business organization, or I'm not sure what the equivalent is in our just communities, but it's something very similar, that there are things that we need to internalize and change that require everybody to actually see the same thing about this. Because we can easily push down over here too hard and cause a problem, okay, that doesn't cause the balance that we want. We have a couple of really good examples of how that looks if we do that. One is the move away from paper grocery bags in the late 80s and early 90s into the plastic bag. Okay, the commentary around that looks exactly like packaging commentary today, only minus the CO2 discussion. That wasn't the driver. It was preservation of tree that was the driver. So the narrative back then was we preserve all the trees we're cutting down. The plastic bags are lighter and they're more utilitarian. Fast forward today, in my world, plastic, hybrid containers, metal, whatever, lighter, okay, they save, allegedly save CO2, but there's an enormous waste, food contact, all kinds of things that we don't know about now. And if we were really concerned about the equilibrium here, we would look more broadly at what we're doing with those things and consider that everything has its place in time. My son's a chef and I love mise en place. That's the same thing is true with a lot of these things, right? Plastic isn't going away. It has a place. Its place might not be for every food and beverage container that we have. Aluminum has its place. Glass has its place. Glass certainly, you know, it probably isn't the ubiquitous choice for everything that we would put, you know, for beverages. But we need to understand and appreciate that there's a balance that needs to be achieved, not only between these things, but in the, I don't know, the different pulls that are going to occur on the equilibrium we want. That may be really out of kilter. You know, we're out of kilter on CO2 now for choices. We're out of kilter on plastic for reasons, right? And we all have to see the value chains and the communities have to see that the same way.
Well, the circularity of the, you know, as it moves towards roles that come in and innovations that come in that help that circularity, it again, you know, keeps changing. Like, I think plastic, as some of the companies that are putting in to the breakdown of plastic, that they've developed some kind of material that makes it as strong as it was when it was first made.
for reuse and that that can be injected forever. So that changes the whole game of recyclability of plastic and the adoption, because then you don't have, you know, squishy replast recycled bottles and this, that, and the other. So I think that that innovation on that, the whole circularity, you know, economy is critical, and it keeps changing.
Really good examples of this that exist in some of the most basic stuff that we do and how we approach this. And the best one I can think of that's easy to see is recycling. So people often complain about the fact that we can't recycle this or don't recycle that in the US, and they look at other places like Europe and they say, those guys are really good at that. Glass recycling rate in Europe's 80% on average versus 30% more, give or take, in the way we do recycling in the United States, outside of some other things. And they ask, this gets back to behavioral psychology. Everything comes back to that for me. Why is that true? It's because the Europeans treat those things as commodities that they want to preserve and reuse in some capacity. They're not asked to treat it like garbage, which is what we're asked to do when we combine, when we combobulate 100 different things and expect that we can discombobulate them with enough efficiency that it preserves value of the different components, which it doesn't take a lot of education to understand that while we may be able to do something with that, we're never going to get the efficiency if we did a little bit of source separation on the front end. And the key would be, how do we do that? Well, when you look at the circularity arguments about what people are doing, there's disparate ways to view that. Right now, the plastic industry is being attacked from all sides about the amount of waste that's in the environment and how little of it gets recycled. The easiest solution for them is to have everybody put as much of that into a single stream recycling bin, in theory, as possible. Only there's no empirical evidence in the United States that any level of increase in this without systematic changes will actually cause progress. But there's simple things that we do know, and this isn't a panacea, but if you actually incentivize people with money to source separate their stuff and then have to return them in some capacity, it's remarkable how many people do that. So even in a state like California, where they have a couple of different ways to recycle, they do have recycling refunds. And while they don't perform as well as some other states, they perform at a higher level than the general recycling rate. And so if you really wanted to collect all your plastic beverage bottles, there's empirical evidence that that works really well in the United States, and by the way, elsewhere. But because we're not focused on what I would say creating the equilibrium that I'm talking about in the same way, we have these different pulls that don't necessarily get us to the place we're all rowing in the same direction with the same speed and the same objective. So a lot of behaviors to influence and a lot of gaps to close in terms of asks and things. So
you just reminded me, when I was a kid, I grew up at the beach, and a couple of beaches down, it was called Tin Can Beach, because the day people just threw tin cans on the beach and they turned rusty. But the beach I was at the end of the day, I'd go to the snack shop and they would hand me a gunny sack and I would walk the beach picking up all the glass bottles and drag it all. Well, that gunny sack was heavy, drag it back to the snack shop, and they would give me 5 cents per bottle on that. So
who knew? Way back when.
Yeah. Back around behavioral psychology, you said that you're constantly innovating and leading. What really drives that?
Well, I think it's the nature of our business and the people that work there. That's where it really amounts to. I mean, if you just look at the company history, Michael Owens, one of the founders of the business, created the machine that mass produces glass containers in the early part of the 20th century. That innovation changed the way manufacturing of these operated, did a lot of things. Okay? At the time, there were a lot of children working in manufacturing, and that completely eliminated the need for them in this industry. We've continued to engineer glass containers and glass container making equipment ever since, right? So our company invented half the equipment that makes glass containers today, right? Over the course of time. And we're proud of that heritage. We have, you know, a few thousand patents of our team, and we get them every, you know, we're starting to get them every year. And we have done that for economic reasons, obviously, but we also continue to improve what we're really good at making, which is glass containers. We made them lighter over time. In our company right now, we're the only glass container manufacturer that has an in-house R&D function. We have that for a reason, right? It costs money to do R&D. And, you know, we are actively looking at how to reinvent how glass is made. And we've got some proprietary technology that we've been perfecting and are introducing into our manufacturing footprint. In fact, our first factory that's going to come online here this summer in Kentucky. And it's just what we do. I mean, that's people come to work at this company versus other companies because we are constantly thinking about how to make this better. And it is a natural evolution for us to make sustainability and making our process, the process that makes the most sustainable product, more sustainable, right? That's just part of the evolution of this. And it's also in part because that's the way the world's moving, right? It's the license to do business is going to be involved with that at some level. Society's only going to give you permission to do that if you're actively doing that. There's value in creating that into the products and the production line.
Your customers want it.
Their customers want it, which is you got. So we all want that. And I just, you know, there are certain industries where you work in them and they are, you know, the tech industry, California is one of the most, some of the most innovative, you know, people work in that industry because they thrive on those kinds of things. Our organization is old line manufacturing organization that also is very good at innovating these processes and coming up with things. I think people seek out those organizations based on their interests, all right? So simple as that, it's our people and their interests.
Yeah, and that really talks to the talent acquisition aspect of sustainability, not necessarily being the sustainability ratings and a company being, you know, high and all these things, which really can be misleading, but the R&D can be as attractive or more attractive than just what the company's doing for sustainability. So I think it's sort of interesting that way. Also, I wanted to ask you, what about the leaders? Do you feel it has to be from the top? Is it always come from the top? Or how do you navigate that sort of complex landscape of organizational change?
That's a great question for a number of reasons. And you could probably get me to not stop talking about it. So the tone at the top always matters. One of the things that we do is we like to follow leaders that chart the course for us that we can't see. That's kind of what leaders do. But when you think about it like that, if you have leaders that want to chart that course and they're showing you the way, the likelihood that the people that are in their charge, as it were, are going to follow them. What makes it better is that there's a lot of people that are already set to follow that have the same motivation to go in the same direction and are actively looking at the same pathways. And so it's interesting whenever we have a sustainability announcement of some kind or something happens. You know, we're one of the folks identified by the Department of Energy to participate in a process to get a decarbonization money as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. We got a pretty sizable piece that we can negotiate with the DOE for, but somebody was congratulating me for it. And I said, actually, I have a great sustainability team. It's the whole company. So what I would say is it starts with the tone at the top. There's always a base and there's always a middle and there's always, some others. So I think a tone at the top matters. It's not really hard to navigate when your leaders are aligned with that, and ours are. And when you have both, when you have grassroots and you have coming from the other direction, it makes the momentum go quicker, right? So I think there's always some, negotiation that goes on inside there, how you get everybody to see it exactly the same way, value it the same way, want to move at the same speed, right? Those are because we're all people, we're couch potato, risk averse, loss avoiding types. You're always battling that, right? No matter what. So it's just how we're wired, right? So, but it makes it easier when somebody's giving you a clear vision and we have a lot of people bringing up the rear that really want the things to happen. The same way. It can cause the group to move in the right direction.
And certainly when sustainability is not siloed, really, where you've got a seat at the table with all the tops, senior VPs of almost all divisions.
Well, I'm fortunate because I am on the executive committee and report to the CEO. Our company made the deliberate decision to put sustainability at the top of the company management. And it makes it very easy, very clear to the people that work there what the company valued.
So Randy, who's the dream team? And tell me about the Glass for Good initiative.
So the dream team in our company is really our people. I mean, I can't isolate, there's no we have fantastic people in every part of our company that both lead and do. Okay. So I feel blessed that we have a very aligned, collaborative group of leaders that have a very aligned, collaborative group of leaders reporting to them that have a very aligned, collaborative group of people. So I would just say that, the dream team for us inside is kind of the way we're just sort of all coming together. The dream team and our Glass for Good folks are twofold, right? Because sustainability doesn't happen by itself. It only happens with collaboration.
Collaboration.
So the dream team for me is the civic leaders that are interested in moving toward an equilibrium in their community because they see a gap there. And they do that by collaborating with us that creates the people on my team who do Glass for Good. There's three of them that are really that historically have driven the program. And they get together with the community leaders and we come up with a system in which we help provide glass recycling and connect the dots, right? So it doesn't happen without all of the parties participating. It doesn't happen without the community leaders and the municipality. It doesn't happen without OI's involvement in our suppliers, which play a role in Glass for Good. And then, of course, it doesn't happen without the residents contributing the material to that. And when they do that, our program donates to the charitable causes in the community. The Dream Team is the ultimate set of people who are dead set on collaborating to bring glass recycling and the benefits that should inure from that. And that's how I view that. The Dream Team for sustainability is always the collaborators, and they're always people that are outside your business or organization and include lots of other people because it can't happen without that collaboration.
I'm always interested in what guides a company. On your website, it says, guided by our values, they support our vision, decision-making process, and how we conduct business. They are the essence of what drives our company identity. Tell me what you mean, what drives our company identity.
Look, our vision is to be the most innovative, sustainable, chosen supplier of brand building packaging. And in order to do that, we have a set of ambitions, a set of priorities, and what is the foundation for all of that is the values that the company has that guide them. The set of cultural behaviors and norms that define what's expected in order to make those things happen. And as I was explaining about the motivation for people to come to work for this company, when they get here, they can see that they're what they want and how they want the company to behave is aligned with the values that we have in our vision. So, you know, our vision is very, you could almost call it Simon Sinek-like. We start with our why, to be the most innovative, sustainable, okay? And the what, you know, if we do that right, the what it produces is a business that grows and creates value for shareholders as it seeks the equilibrium that we're talking about. And the how is by living our values and focusing on our ambitions and the priorities that are necessary to make the ambitions come to life.
Might be the last question here. You know, a lot has happened in this whole notion, sustainability, corporate America in 5 years. A lot has happened. So we're going to do another podcast 5 years from today with you. What's going to be the key topic?
So there'll be two. The one is going to be, what's the future and what are we doing? And then the second one is going to be, what would you have done differently if you knew today what you didn't know in 2020, whatever. Those are the two topics. Because the solutions that are going to be presented by the confluence of somebody's vision, innovation to bring that vision to life, and implementing it to transform something is going to create something else. I view this journey as like, I don't know if you've ever driven into a mountain valley. When you go up and down some hills, you get a glimpse of it, especially if you're driving from Albuquerque to Santa Fe. You crest the hill and the whole valley opens up and it just, now you see it clearly. I view the sustainability journey as something like that, but you probably never crest the hill completely. And so what's going to be on the table tomorrow is what we're seeing. Like today, I would say, if we were doing that same thing, I would say, wow, the prospect of low carbon fuels, things that don't depend so much on water, right? Like, you know, Procter & Gamble's trying to introduce Tide that doesn't require any water, right? Which I think is really interesting. So you would look at that and you'd say, man, if we had renewable fuels like some hydrogen, renewable natural gas, or something else, the amount of progress we could make on our CO2 ambitions would change overnight because you don't have to reinvent entire processes that use combustion in order to reduce those things. And maybe you do anyway, but 5 years from now, I think we're going to see a lot of those things coming to fruition, some of which we may not have anticipated. And the view that that's going to open up about what's possible next, would be what we would sit and talk about. Right, because we'd all be excited about the possibility of more green hydrogen or hydrogen fuel cell or something that we don't even know about that is going to unlock a step change, a paradigm shift towards the sustainability equilibrium we've been discussing.
So I'm going to share one thought here with you. At my mother-in-law's house, she's passed, but we still have the house. And over by the side door, there's this little inset that has a door there. And the milkman used to come and put a cork glass bottle of milk there where she could access without opening her door. She had a little look at that. And when they were done, they put the empty glass bottle there. The milkman came and replaced it with a fresh bottle, took that bottle back and recycled it. Now, I got a lot of comments on that. But what about this freaking Amazon guy that is constantly delivering all this cardboard and all this packaging crap daily? Can we get them to take the stuff away and do something responsible with it?
Let me leave you with one thought, because we could do a podcast on this topic forever. The systems that you described originated in the 50s. A company would buy glass containers, and they would create a system by which those containers could be washed and reused, specifically for milk, beer, soda. Today, the way we do returnability largely involves the same process. If you go to a place that has returnable bottles, it's hard to find in the U.S., but exists in countries in South America, Mexico, and in Europe, and actually Canada a little bit, you will largely find the same configuration. The brand owner has the washing collection infrastructure. They own it. To really scale what your comments envision, Gary, we need a marketplace business model solution that sufficiently creates enough network effects to bring consumers and the brands together in a way that allows that to happen at scale. In other words, how do we create a concept in which people can come to the grocery store and there's lots of reusability solutions that simply require them to bring the containers back to the grocery store, that allow the brands to still retain the branding on some of those, such that the brands want to participate in that level and they don't have to be inconvenienced by the things. So I'm basically saying we need the Uber-like or eBay-like or any marketplace economy business model to show up in this to really make that come to life. And I think people are working on it. It's exciting, but we have to, there's a lot of things that need to click before that works out. And I'm anxious to see how that happens or if it happens. And so that might be one of the things that we talk about in 5 years.
Randy, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation.
It was a pleasure being here, and thank you for inviting me.
Take care.
Take care.
Hope to talk soon.
Thanks for listening. This is just a reminder to follow Doing Sustainability wherever you get your podcast. And please leave a rating and review if you like the show. It helps others discover us. And of course, we want more listeners.
If you want to learn more about our agency, Baker, and how we can help you build your corporate brand, align your culture, and evolve your ESG reporting, head to bakerbrand.com. See you in the next episode of Doing Sustainability, where we focus on practical and actionable approaches to sustainability to create long-term value.